watch cartoons. We'll take a look back at where we've been. So let's hop into our time machine.
And welcome to another episode of Cartoon Time Machine. I'm Scarlett.
And I'm Katie.
We're your animates, and today we're talking about a film that I've actually wanted to discuss on the show for a while, and Katie has just seen it, so we now have the opportunity to discuss Wolfwalkers. This is a really excellent animated movie directed by Tom Moore and produced by the good folks over at Cartoon Saloon, the Irish company. Came out in the year 2020, lost to Soul at the Academy Awards for Best Animated Feature, which I feel is like an insane travesty of justice.
I haven't seen Soul, but I know it's not considered the best film to come out of there.
It's fine. It's mid-tier Pixar, sure. Like, nothing terrible about it. It's fine. But Wolfwalkers might be one of my favorite animated films of all time, if not one of my just straight up favorite films of all time. I love this movie so much. It is absolutely stunning. It's a wonderful, sweet, nostalgic story that is one of those stories that sort of feels like it's always been there. I love movies and books and stories like that, that just, it feels right and organic in a way that makes you watching it be like, yes, like, this is the story. This is how it was always meant to go. This is how it has always been. So I love that about it. I love this movie. Love the voice acting. Love the characters. So the fact that this has gotten so little recognition, the fact that it's really only accessible on Apple TV, which I have now bit the bullet and subscribed to, just, you know, because thinking about this episode, I was like, oh, I really want to rewatch this. And then thinking more like after rewatching it, I'm like, I want to rewatch this frequently and I want it more than just my 7-day free trial. So congrats, Wolfwalkers. You got me to get another streaming platform. It brings down my estimation of this film slightly because I'm always going to be just a little bitter about that. but it's luckily my regard for this film is so astronomically high that even bringing it down that peg is still putting it heads and shoulders among most other things. And now I can watch Severance, so I'm going to do that at some point. Add it to the long list of shows I say I'm going to watch and then decide not to because I'm lazy. Yeah, Katie, I'd love to hear your thoughts in particular because you, unlike me, are Irish. And I would love to have that perspective in addition to your perspective as a fellow lover of animation.
So my way, I'm going to spin the tale of what it's like to watch this as a person who takes probably a little too much pride in their Irish heritage is I don't think I'm going to be invited back to watch movies with this friend for a little. It's not true. I watched with one of our friends who has been a guest on this podcast because he's the only person I know who has Apple TV near me, and I was not biting the bullet because I already bit the bullet for Peacock, and I'm regretting that always.
Fair. I don't have Peacock. I don't know why you have Peacock. Why do you have Peacock? Oh, sports.
Because that's
right.
Where sports go. But it's not spoilers. They're in a town in Ireland. It's Kilkenny specifically, which is right in the center of Southern Ireland. I know where Kilkenny is. I probably have relatives who are from the Kilkenny area because I'm from Southern Ireland area.
Are they wolves?
Unfortunately, no, probably not.
Are you sure? You definitely have some wolf in you.
I'll have to determine. I'll do some ancestry work later. But I became very aggressive about booing the English when they came on screen most of the time.
Amazing.
Because this is early in the Irish rule, and the English killed my family.
Luckily, the English are not portrayed as particularly good in this movie.
Because it's made by the Irish, and every Irish person hates the English unless they're a loyalist. Now, a unionist is what I was meaning to say.
Knowing almost nothing about Irish politics, except for the stuff that you and our other Irish friends rant about, this did strike me as a very anti-English, pro-Irish independence film.
And I enjoyed that. Also, go Irish bullies who had just had a Hurley's. That was so Irish. A little group of Irish bullies making fun of the English with their Hurley sticks.
I didn't catch all of those things, but I appreciate you did.
Do you know what Hurley is?
I have no idea what Hurley is.
For Scarlett and our audience, who I'm hoping some people know what Hurley is, but I'm guessing a lot don't. It is, I believe, the national sport of Ireland, actually. And you just have a stick and you hit a hard ball across a field very aggressively and quickly. It seems, oh, and there's like full tackling with no pad, so it's like American football, but actually dangerous.
It sounds more like hockey, which is more dangerous.
Yeah, it's like hockey.
Field hockey, but aggressive.
It's like field hockey and lacrosse had a baby.
And that baby was violent.
And that baby woke up and chose violence. As most Irish people do.
I mean, this was a very violent movie. I mean, in all the best ways, with lots of great action. But you do get the sense that the Irish people are not, you know, all sunshine and roses and beautiful verdant fields. Like there's some angst happening in this film.
No, but I think the best part of this film, by far, and there most of it's good, but by far the animation style is just. It feels like you're reading a fairy tale book with the animations for children. Like, it feels like you're reading an Irish fairy tale.
I love the woodcutting style that it had. It reminded mm-hmm. me very much of Over the Garden Wall.
Yes.
And it was too dynamic animation because Over the Garden Wall had a relatively low budget and was much slower paced.
Early on, we made two references to what things reminded of us of. And the two farmers reminded our friend of Gravity Falls characters because they were... It's the really close eyes, a little over extenuated nose, a little bit of the dumb, like the sheriffs.
Durland and Sergeant Blubbs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was his note, and then I went, it reminds me of Over the Garden Wall immediately.
Yeah, I think there's a very clear line there with the animation style. I mean, I think this is, you know, still much, much better. And, you know, that's high praise given how much I adore Over the Garden Wall. But it has a very similar, that the color palette is very similar. It's a lot of, you know, rustic autumnal colors happening.
Very warm for a lot of the scenes.
So
and then warm. They use cool colors very importantly in key scenes to get the tone across. They switch to those very sparingly.
Oh yeah, when they use that blue, especially in like a magical context, it really shines blue or in mm-hmm. scenes. And the contrast with the natural world versus the incredibly rigid strict shapes and polygons of the civilized world, quote unquote. Another thing it reminded me of a lot was Princess Mononoke. You've seen mm-hmm. it, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I saw it only recently, so I feel weird comparing it to something when, you know, I've only seen it recently.
We've gone over this as the film that has scarred me for life.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you did mention that. Well, sorry.
This has been weirdly a recurring theme in my life lately.
But it with especially with the contrast between the natural world and the cityscape and the industrial world, and the conflict between those two, both visually and thematically within the story, gave me strong Princess Mononoke themes. And it was beautiful. I mean, this is a really just like I can't emphasize enough how much I love this movie. I'm so glad we finally got you to see it. I enjoyed it as much as I did.
I do, and I already liked Tom Moore. This is his third film, I think, in general. It was the third of his Irish folklore trilogy, and unfortunately the final one in the trilogy.
We're now. I don't know.
We're now. It's done very well. But I think all... So I've seen parts of Secret of Kells. I have seen Song of the Sea. Now I've seen Wolfwalkers. And they're... Also good. There's not a lot of people that have just three hits. Like, out-of-the-park hits. I think all of them were nominated for Best Animated.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I mean, they are all incredible. I also have not seen all of Secret of Kells. I've only seen bits. I thought Song of the Sea was just brilliant and beautiful, and I had high expectations going in on Wolfwalkers, and he knocked it out of the park once again. It just seems like his films are just getting better and better. So I'm excited to see what he comes up with next. Even if it's not a return to the Irish folklore, although, I mean, as a non-Irish person, this is a wonderful way to educate me and make me really fall in love with folklore that is, you know, somewhat neglected, I think, by, you know, film and television. I think tends to focus heavily on Greek mythology, Roman, Egyptian, Norse. Are you okay?
My feelings for the film tried to kill me.
I've seen a lot of Celtic folklore, and it's...
I think Celtic folklore is something that's influenced a ton of our media, because they're pretty common tales. Same with kind of German folklore, probably, but they're not, like, referenced in name. Their ideas are taken and used as inspiration, but we don't get a lot of direct things. Because, I mean, druids are a very Celtic thing, and we've seen a lot of druids in media, like the upcoming Dungeons & Dragons film. Got it in. One Dungeons & Dragons reference a session.
Audience of one being the name of our not druid in our D&D party, but is really trying hard to be our druid.
We gotta reference our Dungeons & Dragons movie coming up in 2023.
We will have to break our rule about only reviewing animated things or things with animation.
Take this idea. This is my idea earlier today in a chat.
I didn't take the idea from you. I agreed with you.
Okay.
We should do it.
We're going to be a live action podcast once only for this moment.
There's going to be enough CG in there that I'm going to count it. Speaking of CG, I wanted to bring this up because I find it very cool. In our endless quest to support traditional animation and try to reduce as much CG animation as possible, because we've apparently made this our quest. Interestingly, Wolfwalkers was partially CG animation using virtual reality camera work, which I think is real. Yeah, they have this thing now, apparently. I don't know much about it, but they have like virtual reality CG animation they can do, where they just like can move a camera through a CG created landscape, and then they basically did rotoscoping on top of it, where they use their digital paint to make what appeared to be traditional hand-drawn animation over that. So all the scenes of them running as wolves through the forest, where it's like so smooth and you just are moving through this beautiful woodland landscape, was originally done in CG, but then they went back and they brought it back into that traditional style, which I think is really innovative, and I really admire them using new technology while still honoring the old, because this movie could not have been made in CG. Like the animation style is so intrinsic to the story that they're telling, and it's so wonderfully organic and fluid. It works in a way that it could never have worked in a different style, I don't think.
I was reading this just because I wanted to, as you were talking about it, read about it more. And it is a very interesting idea of rotoscoping, essentially, in a way. CG then rotoscope. So it was mainly used for the wolf vision, especially. So all those wolf running scenes,
which I love so much.
Yeah,
that's
so good.
Blue animation.
So they made the forest in 3D environments, in virtual reality, as you were saying. They printed out in magenta, so doing one color of the primary scale, and going over it with pencil and charcoal. And then they scanned those to digitally remove the magenta. So since they chose one primary color, they're able to easily mask that out like a green screen. That's really cool.
It is really cool. I mean, you can see while watching this, there is, you can tell that there is innovative artistry and technology at work here to make a movie that I don't know if could have been made in another era. I don't know if
we
would have had the quality of animation, but seeing something like this is another one of those like bang your head, like, oh my god, why is every big budget animated movie 3D when we can have this in traditional?
I think to the people who may not have joined yet prior to understanding our quest a little bit more from some previous episodes to talk about CG, is CG is a very useful tool.
What
I think irks both of us at points is that every major media company uses the same round, smooth CG. This is very... And at those points, sometimes you get into a world where it doesn't feel alive. I'm going to use the term here.
You're restricted with CG, no matter what you do.
Yeah. It feels a little plastic, a little unalive, and... You get fluidity, but it's not a fluidity that almost makes sense to our heads all the time. It feels rigid. There's the word I wanted.
Yes. Yeah, whereas, I agree. CG requires a lot of rigidity that you don't
have. It's very
have.
Rigid. But it lets you sculpt out environments, and it simplifies the process a lot. Cell animation, which was the most common type of animation before computers, which is, you would... Cell animation, we will just do an episode defining all these terms one day.
Yes, a little bit.
Cell animation, which was a lot more hand-drawn, you would be copying things, but there was still hand-drawn, and the coloring was very distinct. And a lot more fluid and changing, simply because it was being hand-painted by the artist. Tones would change scene to scene, because they didn't quite color match correctly. And you lose that with CG, which in some ways I think isolates out the artist touch that you get more in those cell drawn. Like I can tell like the artist did this and that. That's why it looks that way. And CG, there are artists behind it, but sometimes you lose their touch to the computer. So this concept of having the CG, which is very well made by the people who focused on that, and then an artist touch, it definitely has a feeling of being more alive, more fluid. Even though it's using, like, the same concept CG works in. I will get off my soapbox now.
No, I love when you get on your soapbox, and you have a lot more knowledge about this area than I do, so I appreciate you bringing it in.
And one of my favorite parts of two favorite parts of how the animation was done. One, they chose to mask some scenes in a traditional way you'd see in regular cinematography. Sometimes you put a mask over your lens, and it masks out part of your view. Circular masks are common to like show you're looking through a lens, like a telescope or something. And Wolfwalkers uses it very well to dramatize scenes by compressing and shrinking your point of view. So you feel they're usually in moments where the character feels compressed or they're like building up pressure to a decision they need to make. And it's very cool because it's just clearly, it's like if you were drawing on the outside of your paper because you're really bored in class. It looks very organic. That's the other word I was looking for earlier. And my other favorite, oh, go ahead if you wanted to comment on that.
Right, I think organic is such a good word to describe how this movie feels. Everything about it feels like natural, even when it's magical, I guess is fair to say. All the movement feels very organic. The landscapes feel very organic. It's just, like I said about the story, like it all feels like this is just how it always was, and they're just bringing it to us now.
So then my second favorite thing, or same amount of favorite, is they made an intentional decision to not clean up the pencil construction lines.
Yeah.
So in a lot of the scenes, a lot of the characters, sometimes they're not there, but most of the time you can see how the artist sculpted the face and the hair. Like you see the natural lines of the artist's process. It just, again, I think it gives that storybook organic feel that it's unique. It's absolutely unique. There are other films that kind of do it. Princess Kaguya is probably the most recent that's not a Tom Moore film to do it that I can think of. To be fair, I think the film I was just watching might have had it, but I didn't. Did I finish the film? No, I didn't finish it, I think.
Well, I love that those little extra pencil marks, because one thing I like about it is I feel like it gives it a lot more texture. You know, one problem with CG, as we've been discussing, is because, you know, it's made on a computer and everything's very smooth, you know, it's gonna feel a little fake even as it tries to look more real. But because you can see so many of the pencil strokes and because you can see the marks that the artist made on the paper, it makes it feel so much more tangible. Like the thing you're seeing is a real thing that existed on paper. Now, in this case, they didn't do a lot of paperwork. It seems like mostly this was done with digital paint, as it is often now. But that doesn't take away from the experience of feeling, like I said, as if you're seeing something drawn in the margins of a notebook. And it makes when the characters move and spin around each other and change their shape, it makes it seem so much more natural.
My follow-up to that is, as I have the Wikipedia open all the time in these episodes, so sometimes I just have fun facts. You're correct. The characters were done on with digital brushes to imitate physical pens, but they were drawn by hand, of course, still. The backgrounds were drawn and painted on paper.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, that's good to know. I mean, that also makes sense given the intricacies of these backgrounds. They look like the sort of thing that we have not yet invented a digital paintbrush capable of getting that level of fine detail.
Yeah, so you're getting a little bit of kind of like matte work in this film. And I went with a different guest of ours previously to the Academy Museum, and I taught about a mats for a while. I was like, see, this was the good old days when people painted shit.
I'm sorry I didn't get to go with you to the Academy Museum, because I think I would have really enjoyed hearing your technical take on everything that I do not know and do not understand.
I'm a sucker for the old ways. That was, my cinematography was either really fluid hand shots, or I want to do it in the old German surrealism.
Hey, I did
give
my
me
best.
Some matte paintings.
I did my best to get us to do a German surrealist impressionist film, and the school didn't go for it, so.
They said no, but then a year later they said yes, and we were like, can we have money to go ghost hunting?
Yeah, that was a priority of our school. German expressionist film or ghost hunting documentary, and they went with ghost hunting documentary, so, you know.
Well, my third favorite fact about this film, to get us back on topic, is I just like Irish names. I really just like Irish names.
I was shocked when I opened up the Wikipedia and saw how Maeve was spelled. Why is there not a V in Maeve?
Because BH makes a V sound in Irish.
No, that's dumb. As a
BH and MH makes the same sound.
I say we must follow the strict English mother tongue. I'm gonna come in and burn down your forest and your dictionaries. Grr. That's my impression of an English person, but I can't do it.
You sound exactly like them, because they did ban the Irish language for a long time.
Wow. What jerks.
Mm-hmm.
They do really come across as jerks in this one.
Because they are!
The big evil soldier man, Lord Protector, really does make you want to just hate everyone.
We did have to look up while we were watching. The Lord Protector is not Oliver Cromwell, their reference. Directly, but they are referencing him.
I don't know enough about Irish history to say. I've heard of Oliver Cromwell. I know he's not well loved.
Oliver Cromwell was the guy who overthrew the monarchy, but then just immediately made himself basically a king with the title Lord Protector. That's not who this is. This is Lord Protector, I'm pretty sure, I forgot to look this up, is a title the English used other times for, like, the people they put in charge of their colonies. So there probably was a Lord Protector of Ireland also. But they decided to use Oliver Cromwell as a reference.
I mean,
I don't know Oliver Cromwell's, the Irish feeling towards Oliver Cromwell. But that's
probably not great, as probably about the same as they do for every Irish person, or English person.
That for me.
But he does have the exact same comb over that he appears that Oliver Cromwell has. So I would want to think that that was meant to be a reference. It was a very specific design choice to give him a comb over, and so was Oliver Cromwell.
This history.com UK article says title is Oliver Cromwell : the most hated man in Irish history? ?
Yeah, so in other words, yeah, they were definitely with him.
To any of our British fans, I'm sorry, by the way, this movie has brought out the Irish in me. I don't hate modern Britain. I just hate the old ones.
I had a great time in London when I went.
Same, I've gone twice. I've enjoyed it.
I ate a kidney. It was squishy. I'm not going to do it again, but I did it. So I'm British now, right?
I eat German food.
I gotta go to Germany. Anyway, why don't we, I think we've given sort of a general opinion of this film. Why don't we go into more of a summary and some spoilers? Because with this movie, I feel like everything is spoilers a little bit.
It's a fast movie. It is almost 2 hours, but it's pretty fast.
Well, it has that wonderful fairy tale simplicity where, you know, so the story itself is, you know, is very quick to tell. And it's, you know, it's basic. It's what you would more or less expect. You know, it's not really going to subvert your expectations in a huge way. But that's kind of not the point of it, in the same way that, you know, Beauty and the Beast was, you know, not meant to surprise you really, but just to tell a familiar story in a new way. And that's very much feels like how this is. So the story centers around Robin, who's a young girl who is moved to Kilkenny. I'm pronouncing that correct, right?
And yeah, at least in the
American accent,
Kilkenny.
Kilkenny, with her father, who's a huntsman, and the two of them, or more accurately, he has been tasked with clearing the wolves out of this forest as the settlement of Kilkenny is expanding outwards under the watchful eye of this Lord Protector, who we have mentioned, who is clearly a bad guy. The huntsman, Robin's father, is played by Sean Bean. And he does a very wonderful job. He's probably the only real like name in this. I think, you know, some of the other actors have been in some things, but he was definitely their biggest name star. And he gives a really warm, wonderful, kind performance, which I think is uncharacteristic for Sean Bean. I feel like I've usually seen him in more of like stoic, tough guys, and he's not a stoic, tough guy, but there's so much love and kindness and fatherly gentleness in his performance that it's really a really wonderful turn from him. But our little girl Robin also wants to be a hunter despite her father trying to keep her safe. So she runs off to the woods with her pet falcon, Merlin, who I love. I love Merlin.
Merlin is the only actually smart character in the whole film.
I mean, yes. You know,
Merlin's a genius.
Falcons are smart. Falcons are smart like that.
But also most of the other characters make several dumb decisions.
Yeah, they do. The story wouldn't happen if they didn't all make the dumbest possible decision for themselves, but also their kids, you know, for the most part, it's Robin and Maeve making bad decisions.
Yes.
And
there was a point in the film where I was like, see, I feel like I should be criticizing that as being a dumb point, and like, this is silly. No, like, that's so dumb of a decision to make. But I do have to remember they are children acting impulsively because they're scared and confused.
Right. I mean, kids will do the dumbest thing when given the opportunity. You know about that. You play D&D with children. but anyway, Robin goes off into the woods. There's been, you know, warnings about the dangerous wolf activity. And she meets one. She meets a little girl named Maeve, who turns out to be a wolf walker, which functions similarly to werewolves minus the full moon. When she sleeps, she turns into a wolf. And
they're druids.
They're druids.
They're Irish pagan druids.
They have
beautiful
healing powers. No plant powers though, that I recall.
Right? A little bit. They were with the hedge into their clearing.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
There's a little bit of plant magic less, but I feel like there was another really big druid moment that I've forgotten. Also just commanding a whole pack of wolves.
They did command a whole pack of wolves with their wolf pack powers. And they like look a little bit wolfish. Like I adore the little details, like with a little slightly darker nose, with like the little like fur texturing, tapering out. Maeve is adorable. And the second I saw her, I'm like, I will protect this little feral beast of a child. She is perfect in every way.
Oh, she's just adorable.
She's perfect. She is perfect. No notes on Maeve, except for the aforementioned stupid decisions. But that's.
But she's a feral child.
She's a literal feral child in the purest possible sense. She is pure id. She is just kind of a little wild thing. Her mother has been captured by the Lord Protector in her wolf form, and the little kids have to go and try to save her. In the process, of course, they attract the ire of the town and pit Robin against her own father. Big fights ensue, and that leads to a wonderfully dramatic climax with her father, spoilers, becomes a wolf walker and joins them. Oh, I forgot to mention Robin also became a wolf walker in there. I'm bad at giving summaries, clearly. I'm just so excited about this movie. But yeah, again, similar to werewolves, it's, you know, you get bitten by a wolf walker, you become a wolf walker. But that means that Robin and Maeve get to have wonderful, frolicking montage through the woods. I think, is it Aurora who sang Running with the Wolves?
Yes, it is, which is so good.
Hauntingly beautiful. She's the same one who did that one song in Frozen 2. And this is, like, that was the best song of that movie. And oh my God, Running with the Wolves is a good song. It's just, it makes me feel so many things. I know technically it wasn't made for this movie. It came out in 2015. But it feels like it should be made for this movie in the way that I love it when songs do, when they feel just so organic to the film and you can't imagine the film without it. And this is very much an example of that. It is just so thematic. It gives me goosebumps. I had goosebumps watching so much of this movie, which is impressive for my rewatch this week because it is 95 degrees in LA and I'm hot all the time. And I still managed to get goosebumps and a chill up my spine watching this just because I cannot overstate the ethereal beauty of this. It is it feels like you are watching something. I mean, the term instant classic, I think, doesn't even begin to describe it. It's just a perfect film. I don't know. I mean, I hesitate to say something like a perfect film because, you know, nothing is truly perfect, but this comes close, man. This comes close. This is...
Oh, certainly.
It's really up there.
It's really good. I also... They do throw in actual Irish language at some points, which was I really enjoy. Though our friend did keep asking me if I knew what they meant.
Did you?
Not until the final Irish phrase. I did know the final one was friend.
Aw, wait, what's the word?
I forgot now. I can read it. I can't pull it from memory.
That's fair. Oh, now I'm getting overwhelmed by the film.
Also, there's a Wilhelm scream. Like a really good, not cheesy Wilhelm scream.
Wait, where was that? I missed that.
When two soldiers fall into a trap.
Oh.
One of the Wilhelm screams, and it's so funny, but not in like, oh, this is cheap. It was, oh, that was really, you guys picked well there. I've heard a lot of cheesy Wilhelms.
Yeah, sometimes I definitely feel like they put Wilhelm scenes into things because it's like perfunctory and they feel like they need to put it in there, but it's nice when it feels organic. I mean, again, clearly so much so that I didn't notice it was there and I feel like I'm more than usually attuned to that sort of thing. So good on them. Yeah, it's just a really just wonderful, it makes you feel warm inside. Like when the ending comes and they all live happily ever after and they're in their little carriage riding through the woods and it's got this beautiful landscape and it's lush and green and there's leaves and flowers. It just makes me want to jump into a pile of leaves.
Like, one of my favorite one of my favorite storytelling moments in it, I don't think was actually shown on camera, but as we're going through the days, it's in a very short span actually, but between one time where they're in the forest hanging, like becoming friends, learning to be wolves, and while Maeve is waiting, one day there's a giant tree in that forest that's right by their waiting spot, and then you cut later to overhead shot of Maeve waiting and the large tree is cut down, and that's right when things start to turn, and they don't show, I think, cutting the tree down.
No, I
on screen.
Know what you're talking about, though. Yeah. Because right, the plot point is that they've been ordered to fell the forest, which of course presents an existential threat to our little wolf pack.
And that's also when the tone really shifts into there are problems.
I do admire that, you know, I think it would have been maybe easy or expected for there to be, you know, some kind of ending of, you know, the wolves are like, this forest is ours, humans get out, and it's like a triumph. But in the end, you know, in it's sort of a bittersweet victory that they have, because they do have to leave their home. You know, they have sort of conceded, you know, in they don't burn the forest down, but they do leave it and sort of give that land to the humans. And, you know, again, not really the clear-cut victory that we would want. And there's never really any discussion throughout the film of, like, fighting back against the humans. It's, can we get Maeve's mother out and flee this area? Which I find very interesting. And I don't know if that's, you know, more indicative of the Irish mindset versus the American one, because, you know, an American film, I think, would very much have the attitude of, we're not leaving, we're going to fight. Well, I was born in this forest and I'm going to die in this forest. Like, there's going to be much more the attitude of, like, we need to protect the pack no matter what. Like, this forest is our home, but that's not what's important. What's important is getting everyone out safely.
It's probably a little based, this is my speculation, that wolf pack mentality of protecting the group and making sure everyone is safe might come from the fact that Ireland's original, like, when these folk tales would have been written, was a clan-based system. Mm. So your family was really important. There was a lot of ties to what clan are you. Your clan was really a social status. So I would bet that a wolf pack really does equate pretty well to an Irish clan.
I mean, and I think that sense of family above all else really does shine through in this film, not just with the wolf pack, but also with Robin and her father. It's a really powerful moment toward the end when Robin is, you know, standing in front of Maeve's mother in wolf form, you know, basically using her body as a human shield against her father, saying, no, don't do this. And he just kind of breaks in that moment, and he just becomes very vulnerable and just sort of expresses that he is worried that he's not going to be around to protect his daughter, and that, you know, you sort of sense in that moment that he knows what she is and he knows what is coming for her. And he fears in that moment so strongly for his daughter's life that he's willing to do basically everything, you know, abandon his principles, abandon at that point, he's, because of Robin's actions, he's been demoted from huntsman to just a foot soldier. And you can tell that this is, you know, the forest is part of him just as much as it's part of Robin and even Maeve and her mother. But he still is willing to do it for his daughter. It's a really powerful performance. Again, just kudos to the animators, kudos to Sean Bean. Our friends have ruined me, by the way. I have to, like, think twice before not calling him Steven Vaughn.
I was calling him
Steven. I don't know where this running joke started, but it is there permanently, and I now have to do an extra step of mental logic.
I'm going to blame our queer correspondent, even though I'm not 100% sure, but it really feels like something from that.
It feels like it's Beth's fault. If she didn't start it, she encouraged it. So I'm willing to blame.
That's fair. The family is just so, yeah, so important to this film. You also have two single parents, and at one point, two children who feel left behind by their parents, in a sense. That the ending is so sweet, it makes you want to cry tears of joy.
I was sobbing in the theater. I was high-key crying.
When he puts the flower in her hair!
And I like that it's somewhat open-ended. It can be interpreted as they've started a romantic thing. It could be just thoroughly platonic. This is our family. Like, there's no, and either way is fine. Like, there's no,
and
it couldn't be either.
Yeah, and there's, and I think that gets into the, like, it's a story about found family in the very end. And found family can have a lot of meanings to a lot of different people. So it's definitely something that people can interpret how they wish to interpret. I do have a question about the other part of the ending, which is the Lord Protector dying. Yeah. I had a question, a theoretical question.
Theoretical.
Because how it happens is Wolf Dad bites onto him and holds him over a ravine. Which would be worse for the Lord Protector in terms of a punishment, because this is essentially him getting his retribution for being a terrible guy, burning down the forest, Persecuting the Irish.
His Disney villain dangled over tall thing. Yeah.
So, in the moment, he unclips his cuirass and falls.
You just love saying the word cuirass at every opportunity, don't you?
I haven't said it in a while!
This is a recurring thing for you, though. No, I'm just going to bring it up, because anyone else would have just said breastplate, and I appreciate you always bringing in the word cuirass.
I think it's because in the fantasy game...
I feel like I have to believe myself saying that. Like,
I think it's because in the game that I... The reason I'm being made fun of here is because it was... When I did a D&D quest, it was very... They were getting sets of armor, and it's based off a quest in Oblivion, and I think Oblivion doesn't call them breastplates. They call them cuirasses.
No, I know. I just remember us all being really immature about it, so...
No, the problem was one of the player's characters was decided it wasn't the brightest bulb in the room, and he couldn't remember the difference between a cuirass and a cutlass. I have to make sure I'm pronouncing it right.
No, I think you are. I can't think of any other way it would be pronounced. Wait, it's not cuirass, is it?
It's cuirass!
I refuse to call it a cuirass. I refuse. I will call. Wait, why are all three possibilities a little bit dirty? My options are breastplate, cuirass, or cuirass. Like, I feel like all three should get us an explicit rating.
Oh, am I pronouncing it the British way? Nope. Where did I get cuirass from?
I mean, because it looks and sounds better than queerass.
I can't believe.
I'm pretty sure if it helps, I'm like pretty sure that's how math works. So that might be part of where you're getting it.
Oh, 100%.
Because no one's going to say queerass on camera, except for us now, apparently, being recorded and sending this out on the internet, us saying queerass.
Oh my god, it's queer.
Did you say breastplate?
Okay.
He says by the breastplate, he says, you know, like, into your arms, I commend myself, my lord, and because he's a religious extremist like all these jerks are.
That's the point in the background of the Abyss is Catholic Protestants. We're also referencing Cromwell, yada, yada, yada. He throws himself into a pit of spikes, basically, at the bottom of a waterfall. But
it's less like Catholic versus Protestant and much more like the old religion versus
yes.
the new one.
Yes.
The old religion.
Continuing.
Focused, yeah.
But what is a... Because it's unclear at first if he's bitten through the armor or not. And if you get bitten, you turn into a wolfwalker. So what would have been a worse punishment for the Lord Protector for his crimes against the wolves? Oh my god, I sound like Kelta.
You do sound like
the wolf folk. What would have been a worse punishment? The death of falling into a waterfall pit of spikes, or having to live as the thing you hate and being a wolf walker?
I interpreted that. I choose to believe that he knew that being bitten meant that he would turn, and that's why he made the active choice to when it seemed very much like he was going to be spared by the wolf, that he would instead say, you know, I refuse to become what is to him an abomination unto the Lord, and instead falls and kills himself. I did a little dramatic reenactment of that, by the way, in this moment. You can't see it because it's an audio podcast, but I hope Katie enjoyed
laughing at you. I just came up with a tail slate.
What?
I'm not laughing at that yet. I came up with a tail slate. You'll find out later.
Good lord. that doesn't make me nervous at all. I think it makes for a very dramatic ending for him. I think it makes for a very cool death. I think I like it when villains are cool even in death. I don't like villains who go out, you know, in a really uncharacteristically wimpy way. Like, I like that that it is fitting for his character, that it is dramatic, that it looks very visually interesting. It reminded me most strongly of how the villain in Hunchback of Notre Dame dies.
I knew that was going to be your reference. I haven't even seen the movie, and I was like, this has to be the reference we're going for.
I don't want to say they copied it. I don't even want to say it was an homage, because I think it's a trope that you would kill your bigot like this. But it's a very similar moment in Hunchback where a character, you know, recites some sort of religious doctrine and then dies in a suitably ironic fashion. So I think that is a very favorable comparison on my part, because Hunchback is one of my favorite Disney movies. So
I just knew it was coming and I was waiting for it.
Oh, similar. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's just everything about this movie is lovely. It's so, I love these girls so much. I mean, talk about the ending. Like, I like that the focus is on them once again running through the fields together, and just that wonderful female friendship that, you know, we see less commonly in films than we do see, you know, young boys' friendship. You know, it's something that, you know, felt nice and refreshing to see, just two girls having a friendship together that's, you know, not related to romance or relationships or boys. Like, you know, I think most like girl friendship movies get very catty because of those kind of elements. And of course, these two girls are, I don't know, probably like 9-ish. Maeve is probably a little bit younger. Maybe she's like 7. They're very young, so we don't have to worry about those kind of elements. And it's not important to the plot. So it's just wonderful to see their interactions and, you know, the friendship they have for each other, you know, more like sisters than anything. And of course, by the end, their little found family, they basically are sisters. And just, it's impossible not to watch it without just crying while smiling. Like, that's so much of the movie, is just crying and smiling.
It's a gorgeous film. Highly recommend it and all of Tom Moore's work. While I was looking up fun facts, the studio has produced 4 films, these 3 and Breadwinner. So all 4 of their films have been nominated for the Academy Award for Best Animated.
I mean, you can see why. Like, it is such clear talent.
I mean, that really alone feels like, I feel like the way to end this is, one, international cinema always deserves more praise. 2, you can focus on stories outside of the U.S.
Yes.
And outside of fantasy, these are Irish folk tales, and Breadwinner is, I know it's a Middle Eastern story. I'm blanking on the key details.
I think it might be Persian.
Yeah. I don't know exactly, but it is a Middle Eastern story. Middle Eastern animation, to listeners, is an area I highly recommend. There is. So I started watching Flea the other day.
I did not finish it.
What I got through was very good. Persepolis, one of my favorite animated films. Breadwinner's very good. There's a few other in that category. French Syrian filmmaking also. Top notch.
Foreign film, man. Well, foreign for us Americans. There's so much more beyond our borders. And, you know, I, again, to bring it back to where we started with, you know, I think there's some just kind of automatic, you know, giving of awards and accolades and attention to the Pixars, to the Disneys, but there's so much more out there that I hope we can do more to cultivate here in the States, because unfortunately money talks and we are the ones who will make those things profitable. You know, it's, we have a certain amount of power, unfortunately, in that, in funding films like this and distributing films like this. So it's a shame that this movie, I don't believe, got a theatrical release, because I would have been there. I don't think it did it? At least not near me.
I think it got a very minimal theatrical release. Let me go double check.
Okay, because I remember looking at it and I couldn't find one near me.
Yeah, it was a very...
It was also 2020, so that's also some of it.
Yes, it got a theatrical release in the UK and Ireland, which were, the UK seems like it went through. Ireland was delayed for a little bit.
Yeah. It's impossible to get this on DVD even unless you buy all 3 of the Irish Folklore trilogy, and that brings it up to $65. So that's just enough of an oof for me to not want to spend that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I don't know if you can find Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea for free on streaming anywhere right now. Song of the Sea was on Netflix for a while, which is where I watched it.
when I watched it, I had to, you know, go through less than a legal means to find it. So
you can rent these movies for the typical like $3 on Amazon if you're looking for them. Apple TV.
I couldn't find it on Amazon. I couldn't find it. I think on Amazon.
I think right now it might be after Wolfwalker's success.
That would be nice. Okay, it's up there now. Okay,
that's it's all the season on Amazon Prime, Google Movies, YouTube for their typical rental fee.
Okay, so yeah, shame that.
And I think
though,
Secret of Kells is also there. It's actually on the cheaper side because it's an older film.
Right.
Of course, Wolfwalkers is only on Apple TV, which is a right shame.
It is now the trilogy Blu-ray set has a 30% off deal right now. It's only $56. So maybe that'll
come. Tempting.
I don't know.
It comes with bonus content.
There's a board game and a coloring book. Oh, these are really cute. Oh, I love it.
There's a board game.
Yeah, this is
But yeah, these are all three of Tom Moore's. Breadwinners is another one. These are all, this studio's produced only bangers.
And they are, later this year, they're producing My Father's Dragon for Netflix, which is a book series that I was a big fan of as a kid. So I have high hopes for how that's going to be. We'll see. Very little has been released about that so far. It might not even come out this year. They said it would, but we haven't heard much for several months. So fingers crossed it is still coming out this year. But yeah, no, much recommendation for Wolfwalkers, for all of this Irish folklore trilogy, for The Breadwinner, Sport Cartoon Saloon. They're clearly an incredibly talented group of artists, animators, and storytellers. So give them all the love that you can, because we want more films like this, either from them or from people inspired by them. Yeah, any final thoughts, Katie, before we wrap up?
No, I think I've said my piece. I got on a couple soapboxes, which is weird for me. It's usually your job.
Between the two of us, we can do a lot of soapboxes, and I'm here for that.
We buy a lot of soap.
I'm going to take our cartoon time machine and take it to Ireland. How about that? You want to come with me to our cartoon time machine and take it to Ireland?
What time of Ireland? We got to make sure we're not in the potato famine. That just ends poorly.
Oh, I really do like potatoes. So yeah, you can manage the chronosphere and make sure we get to a potato abundant time in Irish history.
Great. All right, take us out.
I will take us out. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Katie.
We're your animates, and we will see you next time.
Honey, where's my cure ass? Oh no, I said it wrong.